from Woodland Hills.
My name is Clint Hodges. I'm an alcoholic. And I appreciate being included in the lineup during the Lisa regime, what we've come to know as the Lisa regime. And to be here on a night when the greater Galt group is in attendance is wonderful. And to be here on a night when there are new people in the room, I like that, and I welcome you. And to be here on a night when we are given the extraordinary grace of the quiet miracle of a sober life is so sweet. And I'm glad to be here. I was thinking tonight we were talking about the recovery homes and the programs and all of that stuff, but there doesn't seem to be anything that will appeal to an alcoholic any more than what we call Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had no idea that I would ever be called here. I had no idea that it would be possible for me to stay here. I was brought here by a bail bondsman. We'd done a little business together, and I lived in Glendale. I was walking along the street one day, and a car pulled up to the curb, and I heard my name. And I looked and walked over to the car, and it was Don Armstrong, a bail bondsman in Glendale. And he said, "I'm going to take you someplace today." And I didn't even ask him where, you know. Didn't matter. Maybe we're going back to jail. Maybe we're going to Camarillo. It was still, you know, one of those fidget farms down there. And wouldn't have surprised me. Maybe to the hospital. County hospital gave you jars of pills in those days. I kind of hoped we'd go there. They had one. They didn't have the kind of charm schools that we have now. But they had a place out in the valley called, run by a guy named Ron Shire. Remember, Clancy? We called it Shire's Dryer. kind of a spin dry deal, and you'd be out in a couple of days. I never made that one. I made the jail, and I made county. And I knew, I probably ought to go to a mental hospital. I knew that. I lived in I called it a garage in those days. Four of us lived in this garage. It had been cut up into four rooms. And it really was, a few years ago, Linda and I were over, my wife and I were over in Glendale, and she said, "I want to see the garage." And we drove down, and she said, "Is that it?" I said, "Yeah." She said, "That's not a garage. That's a shed, is what that is." And I looked, and by God, it is a shed. That no car ever got in that thing. I guess I was trying to be a high bottom drunk. I don't know. I lived in a shed. It was cut up into four little rooms, little 8x10 rooms. I had one of those, and there was a shower. I could hear it going sometimes. I didn't personally visit it, but I heard heard guys throwing up in there, and I we're getting all. They'd poke those chunks down the drain with their feet.
touchy-touchy ones.
I had a steel cot with a wet mattress on it in this little dirty, stinky 8x10 room with a sticky linoleum floor and a bare bulb coming out of the ceiling on electrical cord. And I had somehow or other managed to hang on to a radio. I had a clock radio. And those were my possessions. And I had an old copy of Playboy magazine. My social life, essentially. Kind of like, honey, I'm home, you know. And I had the radio was a strange one because it would just suddenly start to play. And it would play even when I'd pulled the plug out of the wall. So if you're new here tonight and you have a radio like that, I know about that radio. Welcome home. I had a rat in there one morning. I woke up under the cot and I looked over in the corner and there was a rat, big guy, scared me bad. And I watch that rat, and he watches me, and I'm out of booze and out of money, and I'm kind of hanging on. And then finally, the first light of day, and I looked over in that corner again, and that rat, in some weird way, had changed into a pair of socks. I don't know how they do that. So, if you're new here and you've been held hostage by a pair of socks all night, I get that too. I know that. I know that. When that guy said he's going to take me someplace, I thought, well, we might be going to the nut house, you know. I had the radio and I had the rat, and that's a lot of evidence. And this morning I woke up in my own bed with a lady that is quite special to me. I recognized her. The minute I woke up, I knew her name. I just... And tonight, or this afternoon, when I got off the airplane at the airport, Gary was there and Cheryl had come along. It's funny how we hook up. Gary was standing there. He had his big book up here like this. A few years ago, I called in for messages at my office, and the receptionist, who was kind of new with us, said, "Well, you sure have an interesting life." I said, "Yeah, I do. Why do you say?" Well, she said, "I'm looking at a message here from some guy in Indianapolis," and he's, "I didn't even know you were going to." "Yeah, I'm going to Indianapolis this week." "What is the message?" He said, "Well, the guy that's going to meet you at the airport is." Got a wooden leg, and he's going to be carrying a big book. And he did. This guy had a wooden leg. He'd lost his... He was a health angel, and he'd lost that leg in a motorcycle mess and had a big book. It was was raining that night. He took me down to the parking lot. He was driving a little Pinto, and I was grateful for that. He had turned in the motorcycle. Crazy guy. I loved him a lot. He had an earring. I kidded him about that. I told everybody that it wasn't really an earring, that the Ohio State Wildlife Commission had caught him sleeping in the park and tagged his ear and sent it. So when I saw Gary in his earring, I felt warm. That guy took me back to the airport on Sunday morning, and he had a gift for me, a little brown bag. He said, I brought you a gift. And we really kind of hooked up, you know, in ways that you do in AA. And I opened it up, and it was his first wooden foot is what it was. A lot of things go through your mind. I walked on that morning that I was brought here by that bail bondsman. I agreed to meet that guy at noon. He had come up to me about mid-morning as I was walking along the street, and I said, I'll meet you at noon. And I did. I didn't know where he was going to. He just put me in his car, and he drove me across Glendale, and we went up a long flight of stairs and into a building smaller than this one. Dozen of you sitting around tables. Something called Alano Club of Glendale, whatever that may mean. And nothing in my life has been the same since that day. I was sober for 3 weeks and drunk, bad drunk for two. I ran across a little stash of amphetamines, and I had a little money in my pocket, and I immediately need to drink. And I was bad drunk for two weeks. And I had been to your meetings, and I kind of liked them. And I knew that it was a nice place. And I even wished a little bit that I could stay, and I knew I could not stay. And I got drunk, as I always get drunk. And now I'm out of money, and I'm out of booze, and it's 2 weeks later, and I wake up in that smelly, nasty, rotten little room and walked over to the club in Glendale at about mid-morning on the 14th of August, and there was a guy in there doing his job in AA, the job he had agreed to do. He had that club open. He had coffee on. And I walked in, and he said, how you doing? I said, I'm not doing good. I'm not doing good. He said, what happened? I said, I got drunk and let everybody down. He said, oh, are you alcoholic? He knew, but he wondered if I knew. And he didn't ask me in any kind of a nasty way. He was very kind. He said, oh, are you alcoholic? And I mustering up all the honesty I could, I said, yeah, I've been an alcoholic about a month now. Something like that. And he let it go. He didn't. He's very kind to me, this man. He said, well, if you're alcoholic, you're going to drink. That's what we do. Alcoholics drink. He said, you'll drink. You didn't let us down. Didn't even surprise us. In fact, he said, if you want to surprise us, get a job. That'll surprise us. And he was kind about it. Really, he was. He was loving. I felt it. He said, if you're alcoholic, you're going to, not only will you drink, but you will drink no matter what. Every cell in my body got it. I drink no matter what. That's what I do. He said, you'll drink no matter what. The people in AA, good, intended, wonderful people, tell you don't drink no matter what. If you're alcoholic, you will drink no matter what. That's what you do. And somehow, I heard that. Because I had tried to quit so many times and never could do that. Oh, for a while. 6 weeks one time. God, I was so excited. I told everybody I'm quitting. I told too many people. Because I can't quit. I didn't know it. I tried many times. Even after I got into the little shed, I was quitting a couple of times a day. It's the last half pint I'll need. I'm going to quit. And I don't quit. I cannot quit. I drink no matter what. That day was the 14th of August, 1966, and I never drank again. I haven't had a drink since that time. Since I got it that I will drink no matter what. And it isn't, if you're new here and you get this notion that we quit, therefore you should quit, it isn't quite like that. I wouldn't want you to think that we have some ability to quit that you may not have. That isn't it. That isn't it. There are people in Sacramento that are heavy drinkers that quit. They're not here. You know why? They quit. They're out shopping tonight. They're not here. No, hell no. They don't come here. They don't need to. They quit. For some reason, a sufficiently strong reason has become operative in their lives, and they quit. When a sufficiently strong reason to quit becomes operative in my life, I need a drink. And if that's the case with you, if you're new, welcome home. We are the people who could not quit. And look what you saw up here for birthdays. If it was about quitting, Bob read the steps tonight. Wouldn't it be step one, quit? Damn right, boy, I'll quit. We're the ones that can't quit. So it isn't that. It's step one, you've got to get that you are toast. Basically powerless, unmanageable. You've got to get that you are toast. And I got it that day, 33 years ago. Slender reed, boy. What seemed at first a slender reed has turned out to be the loving and powerful hand of God in my life and in the lives of these people. We didn't quit. And I don't think I'm keeping myself sober. It says in chapter 8, God has either solved your drink problem or he has not. He solved mine. I didn't do it. It's beyond me to do that. I don't have any power. And I want power. We do. We're power seekers. And we don't have that power. And it took me a while, a good while, in Alcoholics Anonymous to notice that I never quit. I woke up at 9 months of sobriety and realized I hadn't had a drink. God, you'd think you'd know the minute that obsession went away. I didn't know. Just wasn't drinking. Chuck C., who's been dead some years now, but was a remarkable human being, used to say, if I'd have known that was going to be my last drink, I would have had two. Yeah, hell yes, I'm quitting. Hello. So if you're new, it isn't about quitting. Not for us. Not for us. It's about inviting some power greater than we are to take that out. Take it out. Please take it away. It isn't about help me quit. It isn't about I'll do my part and you do yours. No, no, no. Take me to a place where I can let that go. As frightening as it is to think of a life ahead of us without any alcohol, without any chemical peace of mind, it scares me to death. It's awful. But I had no choice, and perhaps you don't have a choice. I didn't really have the idea that... I didn't know how crazy I was, basically. I woke up, as I said, at 9 months of sobriety, and I hadn't had a drink. God, that's so touching. That is such a miracle. And then it was some years before I realized that there's something else the matter with me. There's something else the matter with me. I quarreled with whether that step two applied to me, restored to sanity. And I was told that it isn't about that. It's not about whether you were insane. It's about what would sanity look like in your life. And I really didn't know what sane relationships would be. What a sane relationship or a sane attitude or a sane reliance on God would be. I didn't know. And I was brought up in the middle of all of that. Very, very strict, fundamentalist, Protestant, Southern Baptist kind of stuff. Church all the time. My mother always wanted to know, what will you do when you meet your maker? Oh, Ma. Apologize, I guess. Hey, sorry. Have you found God yet? Got baptized in the Yellowstone River early one March outside of Billings, Montana. Yeah. I didn't find God then, I'll tell you. I'm 13 or so. I didn't find much anything for about 3 days, as I recall. They frightened little Clinty with that, I'll tell you. Damn. I was sober a while, and a guy said, make a list of all the craziest stuff you ever did. Because we were talking about this idea of being restored to sanity. Make a list of all this stuff. And I went back to him with my list. And I got a list, and you got a list, and it's crazy stuff. The first time I ever got arrested was off of the fire escape at the Tri-Delt house at the University of Oregon. I had been drinking in an off-campus bar earlier in the evening, and there was a very pretty girl in there who I was told was a member of the Tri-Delt sorority, and She almost looked at me, so I felt we had something going. And so I went up that fire escape ladder at midnight to discuss our future with her. And the cops pulled me off of there, and I spent that night in jail. So that goes on my list. It's crazy. And I was telling Cheryl, I was at dental school a couple of years later at the University of Oregon. And dental school is not for a guy like me. We had a clinic on Saturday morning at 8 o'clock till noon. Somebody sitting in a chair, somebody waiting for me to do something. And I got drunk on Friday night and dropped a couple of 15-milligram spanchels of Dexamil on Saturday morning. That gives you kind of a fine tremor. And they just come out with that new high-speed air-driven handpiece. Oh, I know. They don't like to hear you say whoops when you're screwing around. I made a set of dentures for a guy the first year I was up there, and he came up the second year, and he'd see me at the end of the clinic, but he brought his wife up for something or other, and he'd see me, he'd go, hey. Something wrong with my teeth. They threw me out of there, and they should have. That went on the list. I'm drinking on Skid Row waiting to go in the Marine Corps, and I wake up out of a blackout in a Skid Row bar on Burnside Street in Portland, and I'm sitting across this carved-up wooden table. It's lit about as romantically as this room, and cops strolling through. And I'm suddenly aware that I'm sitting across the table from a lady that I had do not remember meeting. I don't know how long we'd been together or the nature of our relationship or what we were all about. I felt like we were on the road together because she had her things with her in paper bags. And I didn't know her name. I didn't know what was going on. She had a little, she was asleep, so I didn't ask her. She had some chili on her cheek, so I knew we had had dinner together. Some delicate flower that I'd invited to dine that night. There's a line in the book, in one of the personal stories in the back, it says, somehow I got out of there. That's my life. Whether it's jail or a marriage or Marine Corps, whatever, somehow I got out of there. Fight. I got out of there. And I went in the Marine Corps, and that event went on my list in the Marine Corps thing, getting a commanding general at El Toro. And I love being a Marine. I love being a Marine officer. Going through officer candidate school was not an impossible deal for me at all because they didn't let us drink. Couldn't get away anywhere. Once I got that, I could kind of get my sleeves rolled up, and so I was commissioned. But when I got out into the Fleet Marine Force as a junior officer, I was in trouble pretty quick. And a commanding general at El Toro, the Marine Corps Air Station, offered me a chance to resign my commission to avoid a trial by court-martial. Bad day for me, boy. Because I love the Marine Corps. And to think that I could not pack the gear, that I could not take my place with those warriors, bothered me a lot. And I'd go out north of the base in the orange groves they had then and drink hot vodka and pass out. And that was on my list. And slapping a child was on my list. And denying the existence of my wife and family to impress a woman in a bar was on my list. And moving out of the Marine Corps by the skin of my teeth with a good discharge. And going to Glendale and in the apartment for a while and then in the car and then in the shed. My last drunk driving, I'm stopping in the, at 10 in the morning for a red light, and I never got going again. And the guy that was right behind me was in a cop car, and he pulls me out of the car. And I don't know what happened next, but I know 3 weeks later I'm looking at the arrest report, and he says, I discontinued the field sobriety test because the suspect was injuring himself. That's a colorful list. And I said, yeah. He said, but the craziest thing you did isn't on that list. Didn't make your list. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, there's one thing that flows all through this that you did that isn't on your list. And it isn't drinking, although drinking is all through here. I said, what is it? He said, this thing you did it repeatedly, and you did it from a dry brain. You did it before you started to drink. I said, what are you talking about? He said, with all this evidence in that you should never drink again, and before you started to drink, each time, and from a dry brain, you did something that's really nuts. You decided to take another drink. Decided a drink would be a good idea. Not from the craving that one drink will set up, but from something else. There's something else the matter with you. And that's a bad problem. You got an obsession. You got a mind that lacks proportion and can't think straight. You got a mind full of old ideas that don't work for you. And you got an ego, he told me, that Schumacher describes as something in me that will adopt a stupid position and defend it till the bitter end. Must be the master of my destiny. Brooks no interference from man or God. Resists any attempt to attack the integrity of a very weird wire-up. And that's a problem, and I brought that mind into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't know it, because the thing that I would ordinarily use to evaluate my mind is my mind. And when I have an old idea. When it's my old idea, it doesn't seem like an old idea. It just seems like that's the way that it is. And so I'm living my life from my ego in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm doing all of this stuff. And when I was 5 years sober, somebody told me to go to law school, and I did that. And when I was 9 years sober, they gave me a license to practice law, passed that bar, did all that. Which is something. I mean, they wouldn't give me a license to drive a car when I got here, you know. We're moving right along. But I got a strange way of looking at the world around me. Driving down the freeway, and if somebody pulls into my lane, and we know it's my lane, right? You notice that language? Isn't that great? Just occurred to me some months ago on one of those rare Saturdays when Linda and I hadn't much to do. We woke up. She said, what do you want to do today? I said, I haven't even thought about it. I could hang out with you. She said, yeah, let's do that. She said, I said, what do you want to do today? She said, let's give up an old idea. Not so fast, pal. But I'm a good AA, good AA. So I say, sure, let's do that. She said, good, you go first. You know, what's funny is that I had been chewing on something. See, it says in that book, there'll be a constant disclosure. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. I don't have a sense of constant disclosure. And I don't know why that would be. And I'd been thinking about it. And I was sort of getting the idea that the reason that I didn't have any kind of a sense of constant disclosure was because I've got all these barriers up about disclosures and about who can make disclosure to me. And it isn't the guys I sponsor, and it isn't my wife, and it isn't the people, and it isn't the lawyer on the other side of the case. My sponsor can make disclosure to me on Tuesday afternoon from 3 to 3:15. I mean, I'm really defended with all of that, you know. And I knew that. I knew that. I knew it was blocking it. I knew that I knew I had an old idea that I get to set the rules about the disclosure. Somehow or other, it came out of my childhood that I won't be told what to do. No. And I knew that I was at a point when I had to ask that old idea to be taken. And I did ask. And so today, on the way to the airport, a woman pulled into my lane. And on her bumper, rear bumper, was this little sticker. It said, "Relax, it's just a lane change." And I'm laughing, you know. Come on in, come on in. Different view of the world, you know. Keeps on going. But I didn't know all that then, and I had to, after a significant time in sobriety, start looking at these steps again. And it happened at about the time that all of this stuff that I'd brought into my life to get an image going was just astonishingly taken away in about 3 months. My law partner came to me and said, "I don't want to do this anymore." I started to say relationship. Whoever was here was not a relationship. It's funny what we will call a relationship. She said, "I'm going. The house is on the market. The cars." The most frightening time of my sobriety. And I wound up in Nashville at a conference. I'd always had trouble with relationships. If they get too close, I get so scared. So scared. Two things happened in Nashville. One of the entertainers said, he said, "I don't get married anymore. What I do every 5 years, I go out and find a woman I hate and I buy her a house." And I thought, well, and that's about as effective as I had been with it. But the other thing was, I sat up late in one of the rooms of one of the other speakers, several of the others, and they knew a lot about this book, a lot about these steps. And I was just desperate enough that I knew I had to do that again. Go through there and assume that every piece of it is true and every piece of it applies to me after years of sobriety. Every piece of it. Every piece. And it started a trip for me that was quite astonishing. Now, the stuff I lost came back, it does. And I didn't know, somebody said this, I didn't know the difference between everything and nothing. I thought I'd lost everything and was left with nothing. And the nothing I was left with turned out to be everything. And the everything I thought I lost turned out to be nothing. Nothing. Oh, what a trip I had. Oh, God. Talk about going through that book line by line and looking up the words in a dictionary. I thought I knew what words meant. Do you know what? Willing means gladly ready.
Damn. I always thought it meant gun to the head time somehow. You know what recovery means? A guy called me not long ago, because now I take guys through the steps, and what fun we had. He said, I just looked up recovery in the dictionary. I said, what did you find? He said, one of the definitions is this: the extraction of something precious out of that which appears to have no value. And I'm going, isn't this sweet? I went, so I took a look at We Agnostics, because it is step two. I didn't even know that. Everything up to that chapter is step one. What a remarkable group of chapters that is. And then step two and chapter four, and it's like, is God everything or nothing? I'd never really answered that question. And these guys were so good with me that they gave me another way at it. Because I think, well, he's not nothing, but I don't think he's everything he's cracked up to be. Walking that middle ground. God, I love the middle ground. And the middle ground is quite important to me because, well, it goes like this. I can crawl around on the floor in that little room in the shed, or I can turn myself into God. And if I do that, he's going to send me to China to be a missionary. In either case, whether I'm crawling around the floor or in China to be a missionary, I don't have any control over my life. And my ego says, no, thank you. No. So let's try the middle ground. Get a sponsor you don't really... You can get slick with a sponsor. I don't have... You know all that. It gets to be not being accountable at all. In any case, this business about is God everything or nothing, they gave me another look at it. It's a fascinating look. They said, don't answer that question yet. Answer this one. What five things will you not give up for a better relationship with God? Oh, I got five things. Oh, you bet. Rage, control, greed, groin. Greed and groin sounds like a dinner house, doesn't it? Let's go down to the greed and groin for my career, my image. Oh, God, my image. Oh, my image. Did I mention image? Oh. And I think I had seven. And they said, and so number eight would be a better relationship with God? I said, yeah, I guess so. I said, yeah. We know now where you go first for power. Because it's all about power. Because I'm a power seeker. I really want power. Lack of power wouldn't be a dilemma for me if I didn't dig power. So I go there for power. To all of those places. Not a good source of power for me. See, I've known since I was five I'm not big enough for this world. And maybe, I just knew that. And I also knew two other things. I knew I should be big enough for this world, and I must keep you from finding out I'm not big enough for this world. I'm just not. And so maybe me and the money I can steal from my grandma's purse, maybe that's enough. Me and the candy I'll swing with from the store to give to the other kids. Me and booze. Me and a lie. Maybe that's enough. And it never was enough. Booze seemed like it was enough. But I'm out of power. And I don't even know what I'm... Somebody said this the other night. I was very touched by it. He said, there is one who has all power. It means all power. I don't have nothing left over for me. That's so tough for an ego to go with. But now my ego is kind of smacked. And when I get separated from one who has all power, the result is a deep sense of powerlessness. and I can't stand it. Some people seem to be fine, non-alcoholics, with all of that. They don't need to be connected, tucked in. But I seem to need that very much. Otherwise, I wander this world in a strange, uptight sense. There's no peace for me. There's a sign. In Tucson, there's a halfway house, a nice one. And in their foyer is a painting of a drunk. Oh, God, you can tell he's a drunk. He's just sitting at the curb, and his bottle's empty, and his eyes are empty, and his shoes are gone. One shoe is gone. And he just has that posture of a drunk. And there's a piece of verse up at the side of it that I have had on my mind lately. I saw this some years ago. The verse says, "It's true, I'm a drunk, and my soul lives in the shadow of my emotions. And yet there have been songs for me, and my life has had its meaning, but the hand that made me and all that I have ever been has deserted me." And the last two lines, the guy says, "Would anyone ever know that my life, with all its ruined hours, has been a search for him?" Search for him. And it's been that. It's been that. And I long to come home, and I don't know how to go there. And I don't know how to forgive. And I don't know how to do any of it to heal all the wounds there were. And now I'm looking straight at it. Is he everything or nothing? Or do I go for power? And when I come up empty time and again, I blame. I think the problem is out there. Happiness is knowing who to blame. But if the problem is out there, I don't have an answer. The answers are all interior to me. Because that's where the great reality is. And I didn't know that, and I'd been sober a long time. And you know, you go to, they taught me a prayer. They said, just as to each one of these things that are more important than a better relationship with God, ask that it be reprioritized so that it's less important. And within about 2 weeks, because I was desperate and willing, gladly, ready, there came a day when there was nothing more important to me than a better relationship with God. I had come home, and I didn't have the relationship yet, but I knew that that was the most important thing to me. And then there were some experiences of that. And a knowledge that the great, not a really knowledge, but a gut deep sense that there is a place inside me where I can go where God is. And that has never left me. And I connect up. The divinity in me connects up in some way with the divinity of the universe for a moment or two, but it's profound and it carries me, and the prayer changes. The prayer changes. There's three kinds of prayer. Aside from the Lord's Prayer, which is about relationships, and I didn't say this, somebody said this. There's three kinds of prayer. There's the prayer we all know, "Help me." Good prayer. Nothing wrong with that prayer, boy. And another prayer, the second kind, "Give me." Good prayer. "Grant me the serenity" is one of those prayers. But the other prayer, the third kind of prayer, "Use me. Use me." Comforts me because it suggests that he's already given me all there is to give me. Help me anytime I ask. Now, use me. Because we all long to be useful, and it's what so much of the book about, even amends. Our real purpose is to increase our usefulness to God and to our fellows. That. And so I got, step three was easy, finally. And four was a look at power. Why would he have me start with my resentment? Who do I resent? I resent people that seem to have more power than me. Even a guy on the street in L.A. that comes up and asks me for a buck at that moment has enough power to make me feel weird. You know, and he goes on my list.
And that fear inventory is the same thing. What am I afraid of? I'm afraid of power. And the sex inventory is a chronology of all the ways I've tried to extract power from a situation that is not a legitimate source of power. You read that to somebody and you got a whole list of old ideas that float up and defects in you. Look, are you ready to let this go? Yes. Do you have a God that's big enough to take it away? Important question, because I'd been doing business with a little tiny guy up till then. You know what I mean? My God was just kind of, I couldn't even get that he had taken the obsession away. I thought I was taking, you know how to miss the miracles in your life? Take credit for them. Yeah, just take credit for them. I did that. And so 6 and 7 were interesting. 8 was interesting. 9, I got on the road. Direct amends. I was telling somebody that a gal, we were talking about that. Can I make amends by email? Did you do the harm by email? No. Direct amends. I had to sit down with all of them. And the question gets to be after you tell them, I'm so sorry. I'm sorry I took your money, your dignity, your peace of mind. I'm so sorry. Because by now you know, I didn't want to do that. I'm just trying to protect myself. Oh, I was a stinker to be sure, but I never wanted to live like that. And yeah, what can I do to set this right? And I wound up, the last one was at a cemetery in Billings where my mother had been buried when I was 14 years old. And when I walked out of that cemetery at 14, I was furious at her because I knew she didn't love me. And I went back to that cemetery after a long time of wandering in the wilderness to discover on my knees at that graveside that she always loved me. It was a remarkable weekend. An Al-Anon friend of mine went up there with me, and she was so helpful and supportive to me, a wife of a good friend of mine. The Al-Anons called her the next week after we'd been up there and talking about all of this stuff, and I'd had that remarkable experience in the cemetery, and they said, she called me. She said, there's something you ought to know. The Al-Anons in Billings have taken on a new project. I said, why? Why are you telling me that? She said, because it's about your mother's grave. They're going to make sure it always looks great. And they do. They do that. That's real love, you know. It's the power. And I take guys through and I get a front row seat to a transformative experience in the life of another human being. God, it's something. And these guys, they go out. Their amends take your breath away. I've got a guy that is a general contractor. He did a lot of work after he got sober that he wasn't very happy about. Nobody was very happy about it. And he had to go knock on doors, say, huh? I feel like I didn't finish it up for you. And they say, yeah, you're right. What can I do to set it right? You can fix the holes in the damn roof is what you can do. And he spent a year and a half of his life, about half his time, for no charge, just cleaning it up. And of course, his business is jumping. And there's Tom. Tom just knocks me out. Tom was a window washer, but he was really a burglar. Window washing lets you know where to go back that night. You know what I mean? And he worked the South Pasadena area. And he had a lot of doors to knock on. And it takes real power, not his power, not my power, real power to go up and knock on a door and say,
Did you live here 5 years ago when your home was burglarized? I did that. And I came here to clean it up. And every time he got freer and freer. And his money got better and his job. But he wasn't doing it for that. It just, his life was different. And he got married. And the last one, he'd made all his amends, all of them. Except there was one house left. And he told me one morning, he said, I'm going over there today. I said, ask for the power. He said, yeah. I said, do you want me to go with you? He said, no, I'll go. I said, call me when you're done. This is your last amends. He said, yeah. And he called me at 11 o'clock that morning. He said, I'm done. I've finished it. I said, how'd it go? He said, older couple lived there. I hadn't been able to catch him home, and the 3 or 4 times I'd been by there before, and I caught him home and told him what I was there for, and they invited me in, and they asked me a lot of questions. And I told them what I could remember about the burglary. And I ask him, as we must, he asked them, what can I do to set this right? And they said, you've done it. Coming here, you've done it. He said, why do you say that? And they said, because until right now, we always thought our son had done that. And there's a healing out of it, you know. A healing. A family heals. And he heals. What seemed at first a flimsy reed has now turned out to be the loving and powerful hand of God. And another man gets to live the quiet miracle of a sober life. We call that Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome home.